Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. Our guest today is Justin Schubo, who's president of the National Civic Art Society, executive director of Rebuild Penn Station, and commissioner of the United States Commission on Fine Arts. With an academic background in law and philosophy, he's published many articles on architecture and modernism, as well as on subjects ranging from film to men's fashion. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So I was reading the report that the Civic Art Society produced on the Eisenhower Monument, and one of the things that struck me, actually not so much about architecture, but you might say the kind of political economy, was the role of the General Services Administration maybe not exactly in this particular case, but I think it was described as this agency that spends billions and billions of dollars every year on architecture, but it appears to be one that's fairly remote from kind of the public or public opinion. And I thought this is kind of an interesting situation where the people who are in charge of making these very important aesthetic decisions about public buildings are seemingly doing so in a way that doesn't necessarily follow aesthetic principles. And with your background in law and philosophy and so forth, I was curious if what your impression was of how this situation with this administration or the General Services Administration, how that came to be, and whether that's has certain aesthetic consequences.
So sure, I mean, the General Services Administration is it's an unsexy agency. They are the largest landlord in America. They manage all federal buildings and courthouses. Yeah. And at times, they are the largest patron of architecture in the country. And they are almost always the largest patron of art in the country, since 0.5% of all construction funds goes towards art in and around the buildings. Right. And you add that up and you're talking huge sums of money. Now, what the General Services Administration is building when it comes to new federal buildings and courthouses is the physical embodiment of the federal government. And my organization is dedicated to promoting classical public art and architecture. And we have a deep concern with how GSA operates, since for decades now, they have had a bias in favor of modernist, postmodernist architecture. And we are trying to reform that process. So, I mean, if you look at if I can go way back in the history of federal architecture, the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, who are both amazing amateur architects, explicitly chose the classical style to be that of the United States. And Jefferson in particular wanted it to set the tone for all American architecture. They were involved with the competitions and the design of the Capitol building and the White House and the plan of Washington, D.C., which is classical in design. And starting from that time period and to a large extent up until the 1930s, classical was the official federal style. GSA was founded just after the end of World War II, and around that time period, you know, modernism and architecture had greatly come to the fore, and also there was great emphasis on saving money, and it's a lot cheaper to build a simple, you know, steel box than to do a masonry building with columns and all sorts of details. And so starting at that time period, there was a sea change in design and federal architecture. And you got these, you know, very bland mid-century buildings, brutalism, international style, all sorts of things like that. And ultimately, GSA came to see that their own buildings were pretty bad, disliked by the public, disliked by the people that have to use them. And in 1994, they reformed the process by creating something called the Design Excellence Program, which sought to bring in, you know, major architects into the design of government architecture. And that program, which continues to this day, you know, has buzzwords like innovation, creativity, and it's sometimes even hiring, you know, avant-garde architects, people like Tom Main, I mean, it's pretty rare that the federal government's ever at the avant-garde. And so to their credit, the people who created the system and run it have achieved what they wanted to do. But what has happened is there have been numerous federal buildings or courthouses that have, you know, been, you know, bizarre or ugly or off-putting. And, you know, some of them look like alien spaceships. One, there was a relatively new one in Salt Lake City. There was the cover of the Salt Lake City Weekly had a picture of the building, and it said how Salt Lake City ended up with a Borg cube for a courthouse. And I'm not really exaggerating about what it looks like. And GSA has largely flown under the radar in terms of its decision making. And for us, that's a great shame, since, you know, these are not commercial buildings. These are not residences. These are buildings for the American people and also the people who use them. And I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of people do support traditional architecture, particularly when it comes to civic design. And I know that many federal judges too want a courthouse that looks like a courthouse. GSA's own materials talk about how the federal judges have to be weaned off of classicism, you know, in favor of postmodernism, deconstructivism, whatever you want to call it. And so we are trying to bring light to this process, since, you know, we think that we represent the 99%, admittedly taking on the architectural elite. But, you know, I think it's a real shame, and I think it's something that could change for the better. At the very least, we want to eliminate the bias against classical and traditional, you know, public architecture.
There are a couple of things you touched on that that I wanted to follow up on. One, I mean, you mentioned how there's this issue of economics and, you know, costly materials and things like that. And I believe that occasionally I've heard architects of modern contemporary buildings say things like, well, you know, our clients don't want to pay for nice things like marble or something. And so, you know, you can't really blame us, the architects, for, you know, if we're representatives of this movement, you know, it's not our fault that the clients don't want to pay for fine materials and so forth. And I'm curious how you would respond to people who say that.
Well, I mean, you know, throughout history, buildings have been value engineered. This isn't not exactly a new problem, but, you know, when it comes to federal courthouses, these buildings cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, you're ultimately spending so much money that, you know, the additional cost it might require to, you know, use some limestone or marble. You know, I don't think it's that great in terms of, you know, the percentage of the final cost. But at the same time, I would say that it's worth it. I mean, the federal government is not for profit. I mean, not a for-profit institution. And, you know, you get what you pay for. And if you know, want to be cheap, then you might get, you're going to get a building that does look cheap. But, you know, there are many ways of doing classical and traditional architecture more efficiently than was ever possible in the past. So, for instance, you can use CNC machining to do sculptures. There is the, you know, I encourage people to look at the pediment at the Skirmerhorn Concert Hall that is almost completely done by CNC machining. And you can use things like stone panelization to bring down the cost of the materials. So, you know, the cost of the materials themselves are not going to determine whether a building is beautiful and pleasing.
There's something else you said a moment ago about or I guess the more recently adopted in official values of creativity and innovation. And in some of what you've written, it's very striking that those values, well, let's see, first of all, something that's creative and innovative may or may not have ultimate value. I mean, it could be creative, but also, you know, ugly or something like that. But more precisely, these values are quite a contrast to the classical values, which you cite going back to Vitruvius, firmness, commodity, and delight, and so forth. But I guess my question would be, do you think, do you think that these ideas of creativity and innovation are inherently in tension with classicism, or is there, would you say that they can be harmonized somehow?
Well, there are a couple of things to say. One is that most architects are not geniuses.
Yeah.
And so therefore
most
there
of
is
anyone's not
most genius. Of anything,
right.
Most of everyone are not geniuses. And so there is a certain amount of safety in following tradition.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying you can't have some kind of innovation and, you know, make change from the past, but the question is to what degree, because in so much contemporary architecture, you know, the architects go to an extreme, trying to do something that is completely original, that, you know, they're trying not to make it look like anything else that's ever built, certainly not trying to make it look like any of the surrounding buildings.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that civility is a great virtue in architecture because, you know, a building is not like a painting in a museum, it's public, and it ought to harmonize with its surroundings. And so to some degree that constrains, you know, what you ought to be building.
Yeah.
Now, opponents of classical architecture will just say, oh, you guys are just into like Xeroxing buildings or imitating. A word that I prefer is emulating. So you can still be very much be inspired by the whole tradition of classical architecture without slavishly following it. I mean, you look at the U.S. Capitol building, I don't think anyone's going to confuse that for a building in another country. It's distinctively American.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, there was a time period around the turn of the 20th century when the federal government was doing a lot of building, and they built lovely Beaux-Arts post offices around the country.
Yeah.
And so they were all, you know, theme, you know, variations on a theme. And I don't think the people who have to live in these towns with those post offices dislike the buildings, because they do have similarities with other post offices being built around the country.
Yeah. Another question on these values, again referring to the report on the Frank Gehry Eisenhower Memorial, the kind of this idea of the architect, and okay, Frank Gehry is an example, and I suppose you know Frank Lloyd Wright would be another example. This image of the architect as very, well, frankly, egotistical, very, very self-expressive, saying, you know, this is about me and my expression, in contrast to, you know, the whoever built the pyramids, you know, was very, you know, had a great amount of kind of will and vision, but it wasn't really about them. It's not a monument to themselves. And this contrast that you pointed out between that temperament of the kind of egotistical temperament and that of Eisenhower, who didn't want to wear medals on his uniform and didn't like chrome on cars and so on and so forth, this very humble, unostentatious temperament. And I wonder if, would you say that this kind of self-expressive temperament is especially characteristic of our period, our time, or is it maybe architecture in particular that is prone to that?
So I think the phenomenon you're pointing to is, you know, that of the starchitect.
Yeah.
The idea that there are these celebrity architects who are brand names and who have a particular brand.
Yeah.
When you order a Norman Foster building, you know where you're going to get. It's going to look like a Norman Foster building, or you know what a Frank Gehry building is going to look like. I think there has been you know, an error that's gone on in architecture, confusing architecture and art.
Yeah.
In art, you know, art can be a perfectly appropriate place for self-expression.
Yeah.
Even though throughout history you can debate whether art, you know, art has always been about self-expression, but certainly, you know, you certainly start seeing that in the 19th century.
Yeah.
You know, the cult of the genius and so on. But, you know, a building is not a work of art. It has a political component insofar as that it's public. It's forced upon us.
Yeah.
People have no choice but to live with it, to see it. It just builds the world in which we live. And so therefore, there are responsibilities of the architect other than self-expression.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned Frank Gehry. I mean, obviously, very famous architect who does some very striking work. Ultimately, I think he's in the wrong line of work. I think he's much more of an expressionist sculptor than he is an architect.
Right.
And Gehry himself has said that he doesn't really care about interiors.
Right.
And then you start thinking, well, what are you actually doing? What's your line of work?
Yeah.
And so yes, there has been this big error of infusing architecture with self-expression when, you know, really, I would say in most cases, it's not about you. Look, if you're an architect designing your own house, which Frank Gehry did or Philip Johnson did, and, you know, that house is in the middle of the woods, go for it.
Right.
You know, be self-expressive. But if you're doing an art museum or a commercial building or a courthouse, it's not about you. It's about something else. You have obligations toward the public and toward the client.
Yeah. Something else that I was very much struck by in learning about the history of monuments in DC was how apparently the Jefferson Memorial, which dates from 1922, there is an enormous amount of opposition from the modernists at that time who had not yet kind of taken over, so to speak. I guess Frank Lloyd Wright and Joseph Hudnut at Harvard and Columbia University all were strongly opposed to the classical design for that memorial, which of course ultimately was used. Can you describe a little bit of the kind of, so I guess this conflict goes back a long time between modernists and classicists. Could you talk maybe about kind of how it developed between like 1922 and...
Sure. Well, I think the memorial was built in the 1930s.
Okay. Maybe it was the design. I might have that wrong.
Maybe the whole process started in the 20s because these things...
We'll try and edit my mistake in there.
can take forever. But when the design was proposed, you know, it was during the so-called modern era in architecture. And certainly the important schools had been changing and... You know, so many of the leading architects, certainly in Europe, were modernists. And when they saw John Russell Pope's design for the Jefferson Memorial, which is based on the Pantheon, it's a Roman temple, they were aghast.
Yeah.
You mentioned Joseph Hudnut, the extremely influential dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Design. He called the design an egg on a pantry shelf in the middle of a geometric Sahara.
Yeah.
And... He also, I would say, parenthetically, would later call the National Gallery of Art a pink marble whorehouse. So those are examples of the withering critique of classical architecture that you started to see with the ascendancy of the modernists.
Yeah.
Now, although the establishment came out against it, FDR, who was president, you know, came out in support of the design. You know, he recognized that Washington, D.C. is a classical city. It was a magnificent design. And furthermore, Thomas Jefferson was a classical architect. And so therefore, he pushed to get it built. And it's for that reason why, you know, we have the Jefferson Memorial today.
I also noticed in some of that discussion of some of that history, I guess this book by Nathan Glaser, who was his background was in the social sciences, but he developed this interest in architecture. And it struck me that with your own background and coming from law and so forth to public space, I wondered if there was some kind of parallel there where, you know, you didn't study architecture in architecture school, but as a kind of thinker and citizen. Basically, I'm curious about your trajectory from philosophy and law into kind of...
Sure. So... I don't think my background in law has much to do with what my views on architecture, but certainly my background in philosophy has made a difference. So I was studying philosophy and started to come across philosophers writing about architecture.
Yeah.
And I also have a strong interest in political philosophy and the history of ideas. And I came to see how buildings embody ideas.
Yeah.
How they say things about the nature of civilization, how people in a civilization see themselves. And I already felt that the world had gotten much uglier after the Second World War and started, reading and learning, well, why is that the case? and seeing the influence of certain philosophers on architecture, such as the German philosopher Hegel and this idea of the Zeitgeist and there being a spirit, an alleged spirit of the times that architecture must follow. I was studying in, in what's called an analytic philosophy department, right, where, we don't read Foucault and Derrida and right, honestly, like, really think that stuff is gobbledygook.
Right.
And so it's very much the English language common sense tradition rooted right, in the Enlightenment. And in my view, so much of modernism and then later when you get to deconstructivism is rooted in a certain kind of continental philosophy that is fundamentally flawed.
Right.
And I think if people hear the basis for modernist architecture, they'll see just how weak it is. And then gives a stronger reason for why we ought to reject it.
I was curious if you think, if there are, maybe in spite of what you, if there are philosophers writing today who are writing about architecture in this way, if there are people that you would cite, aside, obviously, read Vitruvius, but, other philosophers who you think are important to.
So sure. I think the best writer on architecture, philosopher writing on architecture I know today is Roger Scruton,
yeah,
who is a British philosopher who writes about all sorts of subjects,
yeah,
but he has written extensively on architecture and has had a large impact on me, if anything, an overly large impact. I should be my own independent thinker. But he talks about the importance of the vernacular,
yeah,
in architecture. And, throughout history, most buildings have not been designed by architects.
Yeah.
They were designed by builders, or what we would now call contractors.
Yeah.
But they could follow patterns. It was literally used to be called pattern books.
Yeah.
And, use this lintel and that column and this window, and you would get perfectly pleasing cities.
Yeah.
But with the rise of modernism, the vernacular is completely erased.
Yeah.
And now you have builders who essentially have no idea what they're doing, and you get, things like McMansions,
yeah,
which are just, terrible, I think, from everyone's perspective.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that Scruton has taught me, is the importance of the vernacular. Right now, architects are so far out in, their belief system that they have nothing to say to builders.
Yeah.
And honestly, I feel like they're so elitist that they don't even want to talk to
right,
the builders.
Right. That's very interesting to hear about that. And I wanted to follow up particularly on the idea of the vernacular, because as you described it with Roger Scruton and the kind of townscapes and things like that, there's this meaning that's maybe associated with tradition and so forth. But then on the other hand, I think you also hear about that very same term, the vernacular. Going back to learning from Las Vegas and Venturi and Scott Brown, using it to apply to this kind of, commercial architecture, roadside architecture, things like this, where it's you could argue, this is populist in the sense it obviously meets people's needs, at least commercially. And it is very characteristic of America and Route 66 and this sort of thing. And a place like Las Vegas is certainly distinctive. But there's also this obvious downside of say Las Vegas or any number of these kind of endless highway strip mall type places where there's no sense of unity, there's no sense of place. And maybe certain older traditionalists might argue that that commercial architecture, which is not about elite architects, but just about kind of pure business, wiping away things like traditional towns. So is there this kind of this kind of sense in which vernacular has to be clarified between the more time-honored traditional vernacular and the kind of commercial vernacular that dominates, most public spaces in America?
That's a good question. So I mean, there are different kinds of vernacular.
Yeah.
And you might say that there's, you know, certain kinds that are more vulgar, right?
Right.
They're, you know, to make, I mean, the vernacular, the word comes from speaking about language.
Yeah.
And there is a kind of vernacular where people speak ungrammatically.
Right.
Or they use curse words.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think that's the kind of architecture
right.
that Scruton would advocate, nor would I advocate.
Right.
That there is, you know, a healthy middle ground where you do have, well, in some cases, architects who are schooled in, you know, what makes for a good building, but still operating within the vernacular and leading by example for builders and creating good urban places. I mean, there are movements like the new urbanism and designers trying to create a you know good townscapes, as you mentioned, as opposed to creating, you know, so-called no places. You know, these like strip malls and you know, or you mentioned Las Vegas. I mean, Las Vegas is a very you know, strange right. place. But so yes, it's the, you know, there's a good and bad vernacular.
Yeah.
And you know, an architect should know, you know, what is the right way to go.
Yeah.
This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Justin Shubo. When we come back, we'll talk more about classical architecture and urbanism.